Hello, welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On this edition of our program, another installment in our ongoing series of Museum Confidential podcasts, which are a co-production of Public Radio Tulsa and Philbrook Museum of Art and are created twice a month. This time around, we're looking at a New York Times Magazine piece that went viral last month called "Who is the Bad Art Friend?" And in particular, we're looking at how that sensation, that story, which we'll get into, inspired the art journalist Sarah Cascone to look into questions regarding fair use and art copyright in relation to a set of portraits that Andy Warhol made of Prince back in the 1980s. The portraits that Warhol made were very much based on a series of photographs that Warhol didn't take, but again, he used them to make the portraits of Prince for a magazine. So let's get into the story right now. Thanks so much for tuning in for Museum Confidential.
Who's the bad art friend? That's the question just about everyone is asking or has a firm opinion on after a viral New York Times Magazine article detailed a years-long legal battle between two local writers, at least one of whom thought of the other as a friend.
We hear the word viral all the time. This went viral, that went viral, such and such was a viral sensation. But very few things actually go viral. A recent exception is "Who is the Bad Art Friend?", a nearly 10,000 word feature in the New York Times by Robert Kolker. The story identifies a dispute between two writers that involves Facebook and a kidney donation, and ultimately explores the question, who actually owns our personal stories? In a recent piece for ArtNet, journalist Sarah Cascone finds a parallel dilemma in a recent and potentially related legal battle between a photographer and the Andy Warhol Foundation involving an image of the late great pop icon Prince. It's complicated. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
I guess I'd like to begin with kind of an overview, because I read this article, of course, like everybody, this big, long piece in the New York Times, and it obviously went around the world fairly quickly. And then you wrote this piece for ArtNet that is kind of using that as a jumping off point, but dives much more into the area I'm interested in talking about, which is fair use and kind of what that means in today's world and how it's kind of a constantly changing thing, and the goal line seems to move all the time as for what is fair use. So, but before we do that, I was thinking about how would I even sum up the who is the bad art friend thing, because it's such a crazy, weird story. How do you sum it up? But you do a great job of that. So for our listeners, give us a quick overview about what that story was and what your reaction to it was when you first read it.
Well, I definitely dove right in. It's quite a long article, and it is very engrossing. It kind of speaks to some darker impulses that I think all of us have in a way that is bound up with creativity and originality and the rights to ideas. So it's very interesting on a lot of different levels. The story is primarily about two writers who met in a writers group, workshop group in Boston. And one of the writers is Sonia Larson. Up-and-coming writer, has had some works published and is more successful than perhaps the other writer, who's Don Dorland. And Don, I think, felt very close to this writer's group that she was part of, but perhaps it was a bit one-sided. And Don decided to donate her kidney and shared this news with all of her writer friends in a private Facebook group. And later, she found out that Sonia had turned that nugget, that source of inspiration, into an entire short story. And she became a little uncomfortable with the idea of someone she considered a friend writing about this very personal decision, and tried to find out more about it. And as she learned more, she became more upset. And she also learned that a letter that she had written to the recipient of her kidney and shared on the Facebook group was basically included in Sonia's story. So she accused Sonia of plagiarism, sparking a legal dispute that is still unresolved. And in my article, I talk about how that relates to cases in the visual arts of copyright violation.
Yeah, exactly. And so that was kind of what really piqued my interest, was because the piece itself, as nuanced and kind of strange as it is, you know, speaks to a broader question of who owns your story, you know, who owns your image, all these things. So you bring this, like you said, into the visual arts world. You use an example of a situation involving a work by Andy Warhol, which is a depiction of the late singer Prince. And, you know, when we think of Andy Warhol, we think of images of other people. We think about Elvis Presley. We think about Marilyn Monroe. I mean, that's kind of who he was in a lot of ways. Talk about where this story came from and why it's different than any of those other ones, and why this Prince situation is unique right now.
Well, back when Andy Warhol and Prince were both still alive, Condé Nast commissioned Andy Warhol to do a photo illustration for an article about Prince. And they licensed an unpublished photograph that the celebrity photographer Lynn Goldsmith had taken of Prince for use in this article. And Andy Warhol kind of went above and beyond. He didn't just make one image for the publication in the article. He decided to make a whole series of Prince images. And so these are silk screens, very much in the mold of his Marilyn Monroe or Audrey Hepburn images that we know so well. And the images didn't really make a huge impact at the time of their publication. But when Prince died, Condé Nast reached out to the Andy Warhol Foundation about republishing one of the images, which is when the photographer Lynn Goldsmith first saw the work based on her photograph. She was not credited. She was not asked for any new licensing for a second use of the work. And the Warhol Foundation, when she reached out to them, actually preemptively sued her, asking the court to find that that image that Andy Warhol made, or that series of images that he made, was fair use of her image. And the case has gone through several different courts at this point. Initially, a lower court ruled that it was fair use. And then in the latest ruling in March, which is a very important ruling for the field of copyright and fair use in the visual arts, the Second Circuit Court in New York found that the Andy Warhol artwork wasn't, in fact, infringing and was not fair use and violated Lynn Goldsmith's copyright.
So Lynn Goldsmith, this photographer, that this whole thing took place in the 1980s. Prince dies in the last few years. So there's this huge gap of time between when these works were created and now. Is there such a thing as a, you know, do they have statute of limitations on these kind of things? It's such a vague and strange world when you start talking about copyright and fair use. You know, what are the arguments on either side of this thing? You know, obviously, both Andy Warhol and Prince are both now gone, so we can't get directly, you know, information from them. You know, if Prince was alive and he said, hey, that's fine with me, that might have an impact on it. If Andy Warhol's around, his input might make a difference. So now you have proxies on both sides kind of speaking for these people. Of course, the photographer is still around, so of course that's the third party who's here too, but it kind of becomes this trio of entities going against each other. Is there precedent for any of this, or is this a new area of fair use?
Well, there's a lot that you touched on there. I mean, first of all, I actually have not really discussed with any lawyers the issue of like statute of limitations. I know that when a work is under copyright, it is under copyright for a long period of time. The general rule, I believe, in the US is 70 years after the death of the creator. But I actually haven't talked to any, I don't believe that there's anything in terms of, I made this artwork 20 years ago, it's still under copyright. I think you can go back, I think. Yeah, I don't know.
The whole thing about what something's commissioned for a print magazine.
Right.
Is it the magazine who then owns the work or any part of it versus, you know, yeah, there's that whole gray area too.
It's very complicated. What I would say is that there is a precedent. Before the Warhol case, there was a very important case with the artist Richard Prince, and he was sued by another artist photographer, Patrick Carew. And Richard Prince is an appropriation artist, and he had taken Carew's photographs of these Jamaican men, and he had kind of obscured their faces with spray-painted blobs on the eyes and other changes to the works. And after many years of court battles, the courts actually sided with Richard Prince and found that those works were transformative. And so the main issue in both the Prince case and in the Warhol case, and I think this also carries through to the Bad Art Friend article, is whether or not the use of the original photograph or the original letter has been transformed in the new work. So in the Prince case, the majority of the artworks were ruled to be transformative, and the court said that there were a small number of the images in the series that required closer examination to determine whether or not they were infringing. And that eventually, that part of the case eventually settled out of court. I assume he agreed to pay at some capacity, but we don't really know what the terms of that settlement were. With the Andy Warhol case, the lower court said that the Warhol silkscreen had transformed the original photograph in which Prince was kind of a vulnerable, nervous character into a larger-than-life icon. And then the Second Circuit court said, no, it's the same artwork. It looks, you know, it's not distinguishable one from another. It's the same image. He basically just changed the color and put some darker lines around Prince's eyes, kind of accentuated his eye makeup. And that was not enough to be considered transformative. And the lawyers that I spoke to for my article, they were very split. They, you know, the fact that the courts couldn't agree, the lawyers can't agree. This question is very open, because I had one lawyer tell me, it's much easier to tell in a visual work of art. You can compare the lines. You can tell exactly what has changed and what's different. In the written word, it's more about, is the meaning different? Is the expression of the ideas different? One of the lawyers says that in the written word, you can look at the actual words and the placement of the words in the clauses and see where they kind of match up. And then he said that you can have the line of Prince's hair or face is consistent in the visual, but the way that they change it is a little bit more subjective. It's a little bit harder to determine the nuance visually than you would in the written word. And another lawyer said the exact opposite. He said that ideas are harder to manifest in writing because it's the language that you use to express an idea, if it's different enough, if you can point it out as having enough of a change to be transformative. And I had one lawyer who said to me, if the Andy Warhol work is not considered fair use, what is fair use? Nothing is fair use. Everyone is in trouble. And I had another lawyer who said to me, if Andy Warhol is not infringing, I don't know what infringement would be. Everything would be open season. So there's a huge difference of opinion there.
Well, and that's, I'm fascinated by the subjectivity, right? Because I was thinking about the fact that we're leaving these decisions up to, you know, of course, lawyers and judges. Judges are not experts on visual art specifically. They're not experts on all these things. And that's where you have all these almost 180s between these opinions. And so how do you end up landing on it? I guess it ends up working its way up the court until you reach some kind of finality at different circuits and different levels of the court system. But when you see that and you see someone make a statement about the potential ramifications, you know, they say, well, if this is like this, it could cascade down and affect the whole art world and, you know, the whole world of literature and everything else. What could be the ramifications of this? Because you talk about in your piece, you use this bad art friend article saying, hey, this Andy Warhol case could impact this case, which is in the courts currently. How do you see those two things if it goes one way or the other?
Well, the Andy Warhol case, as I said, is in the Second Circuit, which is a New York court. So it's not necessarily binding in other districts. The kidney bad art friend story is being adjudicated in Boston, which is the First Circuit. So the First Circuit can look to the Andy Warhol case as a guide, but they're not bound by it. And what one lawyer told me is that the Andy Warhol ruling is written in such a way that it might not be more broadly enforced, that the judge could look at it and say, this is only applicable to visual art. Other lawyers said, could be, but it's very well possible that the law will be applied to writing, to music, to other creative forms. So if the Warhol case is applied more broadly, I do think that there will be more strict enforcement of copyright and less room for so-called transformative use. And from what I can tell, the kidney story has two versions, and one of them is more likely to be considered fair use than the other. Because while Don and Sonia were going back and forth about the content of the story and whether or not it was appropriate for Sonia to have taken Don's story and turned it into fiction, Sonia actually revised the letter that Don had written to put it more in her own words. And some of the lawyers that I spoke to felt pretty strongly that the revised version, which is the one that was published in print, was definitely transformative. Whereas the earlier version, which had been published in audiobook form, was too directly tied to the original words of the Facebook post. And in that case, Don did have a case for plagiarism, possibly.
Does the revision of that serve as some admission of guilt in the sense of, you know, the fact that she changed it in the first place shows that she saw some error in the judgment of the first thing, and that can that have a negative impact even though it's not related? So you have the audio version of this. Could they look at that and say, hey, you knew something needed to be done here. You didn't defend it and say, hey, there's nothing wrong. You actually made that change. That in and of itself is a little bit of an admission of some kind of culpability.
It certainly seems like it is. I don't know legally how the courts will interpret that, but definitely during the discovery portion of one of the lawsuits that Sonia and Don filed against one another, a lot of stuff came out. And that was kind of where the article became really interesting, because up until that point, Sonia had told Don, like, oh, yes, my story is only very vaguely about you. And it's about a different scenario that I imagined surrounding a donation that was inspired by your donation story. And it was revealed in discovery that Sonia and the other writers from the writers group that John had also been a part of were actually talking extensively about how weird they thought Dawn was being about her kidney donation and how it felt like she was asking for congratulations and attention, and that it made them very uncomfortable. And they actually said some pretty negative, hurtful things about Dawn, which I think is part of the reason this story was so kind of couldn't look away, had to read all 10,000 words, because everyone kind of can relate being on both sides of that situation.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny. I was thinking about the fact that how perfect it would be if for some reason this like ends up in the Supreme Court. That's like the, you know, the if the bad art friend case ends up in the Supreme Court, it's like the operatic ending to what it feels like is this crazy story to begin with. But you know, there will be, you know, I was thinking about this in relation to something like The Tiger King or something like that. There's going to be a TV show about it. There's going to be all these things. So in the end, you're going to have all these things that other artists are creating based on the news story that came up from the story about appropriation. So it kind of spins off in this whole other strange thing. Someone's going to sell the rights. It's like, well, who's the rights? Is it the life rights for Dawn? Like, who owns the life rights for this story? Because you know everyone's going to want to cash in on that.
That's totally true. I mean, if that were me,
don't be a podcast about it, you know.
If it were me, I would be like hiding under a rock. Like, do not make any more attention to, because I don't think either of them come off sympathetically. And regardless of who's right or wrong, like, it's just a bad look.
Why do you think that we as society, is it our darker impulses that make us turn to look at this because we just want to see the car wreck happen? Or is it something that, I don't know, I'm just trying to understand why, you know, it's always interesting to me why things go viral and what the cause is. And if there's any connection between them, I was thinking about this. I was also thinking about, if you know about the cat person story a couple of years ago that went viral, or as viral as a short literary piece of fiction can go in 2020 or whenever that was. But that one was kind of speaking to some current social issues that were happening now. It's not as if we're constantly talking about fair use. It's not like, you know, you could go up to the average person on the street and say, hey, what are your thoughts on fair use and copyright infringement? They're not going to have that much of an opinion if you're outside of the world that deals with that often. Why do you think this story has captured the hearts and minds of so many people?
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. I think one, a lot of people have spent many years of their lives at this point on social media, watching people overshare, watching people tell their stories about what's happening to them in the hopes of getting engagement, in the hopes of getting a pat on the back, or I guess a like in the case of social media. And I think we're all tired of it. And so I think people definitely felt that they were also annoyed by this idea of a woman being on Facebook saying, I did this wonderful thing, and then following up with someone who she wasn't even that good of friends with to say, you didn't congratulate me. Don't you have anything to say about the fact that I did this? And then on the flip side, I think everybody dreads being that person that you're being talked about behind people's backs. You're the topic of negative conversation. I think everyone has had that moment where they feel like they want to be part of a group. They want to be accepted. They admire a group, and they just feel like it's not quite reciprocated, and they suspect it. And then they find out the truth that it's what they feared all along. And I think that's what happened to Dawn when she found all these texts in the discovery portion of the lawsuit. I think she's, you know, a very complicated character, because I think she really did mean a good thing when she donated her kidney. And I think that that was something she wasn't able to express in a way that was very relatable.
You know, when I was finished reading your piece and sitting back thinking about it and some of the connections that you made, I was thinking, has there ever been a more obvious connection to that famous Warhol statement about everyone being famous for 15 minutes, right? It's this strange thing that comes back around where that prophetic statement, which I think comes in and out, but the more we get into this social media Kardashian age where everyone, you know, we know the names of these two women and we've never heard of these people before, you know, several days ago, and now they're on the tips of everyone's tongue, and they, you know, they know these people, and they think they know them, and they have this profile, and they'll be that kind of, you know, celeb du jour. They'll be around for a moment, and, you know, and on to the next thing. There'll be something else that will come about. And I just couldn't help but think about that interesting connection there between that statement and how unfortunately prescient in a lot of ways it was. Did you kind of ever think about those two worlds interacting?
Well, it is a really great Andy Warhol quote. And I do think that it's become more true than ever in the last 10, 15 years. I don't think that even Andy Warhol would have seen this kind of instant fame, social media, virality, outrage machine coming.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, he would have been big on social media, though. You have to imagine Andy Warhol would have been a big adopter of social media and kind of understanding how to use that tool to kind of brand himself, because that was one of the great things he did, was he was a brand in many ways. And everyone seems like they're a brand nowadays, right? Everybody, you know, is kind of searching for the brand. And that's how you end up with split allegiances, right? It's like the more this story happens, you have these two teams, everyone kind of is aligning themselves with one side or the other. Although you mentioned, you know, you can kind of see both sides of it, but it seems like the more I talk to people about this story, they're kind of either on Team Dawn, you know, it seems like most people in the end are on Team Dawn in a lot of ways. It's like,
really? I disagree. I think most people find her too embarrassing. She's too cringe. They like Sonia.
That's interesting, but I think that is how it was at the beginning, but it's like the piling on of everything now. It's almost like there's this reverse sympathy that comes back, say, okay, enough, you know? And it's like, it was cringe at the beginning, and now it's kind of like, oh, well, now I kind of feel sorry for having to go through. So it's kind of these waves of emotions, and it'll go up and down. You know, if something else comes out in court, it'll just keep going. So I guess in some ways it is that kind of soap opera where we have different characters we root for every week, mm-hmm. and the story changes. But what's the next thing? What's the next step for this case, and what should we be looking for as this heads down the road?
Well, there are a couple of different things to take into account. Number one is whether or not Sonia could have handled this situation in a more ethical manner in terms of being more open with Dawn and having an adult conversation about how Dawn's kidney donation made her feel and what it had inspired in her. Maybe that could have, you know, cut things off at the pass and avoided this whole legal situation. It doesn't matter, because Sonia had every right to write about John's life. You know, and one of the lawyers I spoke to said, this is where unauthorized biographies come from. You can write about anyone's life story in whatever detail you want, and they can't say anything about it. So even though John was upset, the only case that she really has relates to this letter. And I am not really sure what stage the lawsuit is in, because I was mainly more focused on comparing the precedent set by the Warhol case. But I know that Dawn was seeking, I believe, $10,000 or $20,000 in damages. And Sonia's lawyer told the New York Times that Sonia only made $425 total from this short story. So they've both spent a lot of money on legal fees at this point, I can imagine. I feel like it's got to be in their best interest to reach a settlement soon, because it's really a pretty small stakes thing that we're talking about here.
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by your cool, cultured uncle. You know the one. The guy who knows your folks aren't really into museums and all that artsy stuff and kindly volunteers to take you a few times a year. You're grateful because you love this stuff. Your folks are grateful because they don't quite love it. They don't even really get it, but they know you like it, and that's okay. That's where the cool, cultured uncle comes in. He is the bridge, the connection, the tether between two worlds. Thanks very much to all the cool, cultured uncles in the house tonight.
Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.